Hi, I'm Sarah Kanoski, and on RN I present Weekend Arts. If you're interested in film, music, writing or theatre, then when you've finished with this podcast, come and have a listen to Weekend Arts. You'll find us at the RN website.
Tough pomegranate, I know you. Tender, tiny trinkets lie within.
Anita Barrow reading one of the six winning haikus in our food poetry competition, and you'll hear the work of the other five winners throughout this half hour. Hello, welcome to RN First Bite. Michael McKenzie here, and later too, some tips on how all of us can invest in some good wood and make our own wine at home. But not before we travel 650 kilometres north of Stockholm to a restaurant just below the Arctic Circle.
It's so intimate. They make it like it's a dinner party.
Where there's room for only 12 people a night.
You become friendly with everybody and you're going to be sharing the next several hours with them.
New York food blogger Celia Cheng and she and her husband celebrated their first wedding anniversary by booking 2 months ahead, then flying to Sweden and travelling hours by car just to eat at Favaken, a restaurant that for half the year lies under a cover of snow.
The dish that I absolutely loved most was before dinner, the wild trout roe served in crusted pig's blood. Nobody expected the black part to be pig's blood instead of seaweed, but it was just phenomenal because of the contrast between textures.
So why would people like Celia bother to make this kind of pilgrimage, especially when you live in a place like New York? Well, it can be put down to a reluctant chef called Magnus Nilsson.
I was at a point where I stopped cooking. I didn't cook in restaurants anymore because I was just fed up with it. And I
Why were you fed up with it?
For many different reasons, but I lived in France for a while. And when I moved back to Sweden again, one, I was very disappointed with the quality of the produce. And two, I felt like what I did was just bad copies of what my former employers had done in their kitchens.
And these former employers were some of the best that Paris had to offer.
Yeah, very established, very good cooks and chefs. Yeah. And so it wasn't fun. You know, it wasn't pleasing in any way to do. So I stopped and I trained to become a sommelier. So I worked with wine. And I had this idea that I was going to become a master of wine. I thought that was a suitable career choice.
However, when Magnus was asked to help restock a cellar on this remote farming estate called Favaken, he saw another path back into the kitchen.
We are often portrayed as some kind of ambitious hippie restaurant, which we're not. You know, we are a very ambitious restaurant, but the whole idea behind the fact that I use produce from this region is that we get a very good quality. It's a search for quality. Produce doesn't get better because it comes from a particular region, but it becomes a lot better when you get to talk to the people who produces it for you.
The relationships are important.
And that's much easier to maintain if you can meet them face-to-face, if they aren't filtered through three anonymous wholesale companies and a vast geographical distance before they reach you. I care a lot about the environment and I care a lot about different things aside of the quality also, but those are side effects. And it's very interesting to see, though, how often great quality and great respect to nature and to people coexists.
And I was reading about this fascinating cycle of pickling and preserving that goes on to allow you to supply what you want through the year.
If you look at the vegetable sides of things in particular, there are many different ways of making stuff keep for you. One of them is to chemically or otherwise alter a product, like pickling, for example. Pickling works by you lowering the pH level, either by having lactobacillus growing there, producing lactic acid, or by adding acid in some form, usually in a vinegar. Or you can use other functions in a vegetable, like the fact that most root vegetables are biennials. They are designed to grow from seed the first summer, collect a lot of energy, which they store in terms of carbohydrates in the roots, which is what we consume. Mm-hmm. And then they are designed to lie dormant in the soil during one winter. And because of this massive amount of carbohydrates, they can get ahead in the race of life without much photosynthesis in the spring and sprout a flower and spread your seed before the other vegetables. And we can use this function, you know, this function of them
sort of hibernating.
Yeah, to keep them, you know, you can just put them in a root cellar that keeps a low and stable temperature and humidity, and they will keep one winter.
What does a root cellar look like? If I walked into yours, what does it look like?
It's built from stone. It's basically like a little vault.
Underground?
Underground. You're down 1.5 meters of soil. It has about 85% of humidity, and it keeps roughly between 4 and 6 degrees all year round, which is what you need. It needs to be very stable, both in temperature and humidity, because the vegetables, they are designed to lie dormant under the soil, so they don't like it if you have them in a walk-in fridge, for example, like you have in a restaurant. You know, the temperature fluctuates wildly because people open the door many times a day, and it becomes cold and warm, and
so they're moody, they're very sensitive, they like to be treated with constancy.
They are.
So what kind of vegetables are you harvesting to then store over winter?
The ones that keep this way are the biennials, all the root vegetables. And then if you want to store green vegetables, for example, brassicas, you know, kale, Brussels sprouts, cabbage and stuff, I usually just leave them in the garden because they don't mind sub-zero temperatures for a while. And it's very funny because if you leave, let's say, a kale in the garden and it freezes and you pick it and you defrost it in the kitchen, it's a fresh leaf of kale. If you pick a leaf of kale from the garden, freeze it in your freezer and defrost it, it's going to be a frozen leaf of kale. You know, floppy and strange.
Why is there a difference?
The plant, even though it's very cold, is still metabolizing slowly, and it's alive because it has protective functions in it to enable it to survive a certain time of frost, for example.
Yeah.
It takes a while to grow to maturity, and therefore it has this protection for cold temperatures so that it could withstand a little bit of cold temperatures and then set seed again if a sudden spell of warm weather comes back. The summer, it's all about using things when they are as fresh as possible. So if I would serve, let's say, a green peas, I would send the chef to the vegetable garden during service, picking the peas, popping them out of the pod, serving them more or less straight from the pod onto the plate to really get that freshness in flavor. Whilst in the winter, and the fact that things have been stored because it has to be stored, that will also contribute to the character and the flavor of the food in a particular way. No one has forced me into doing this. I do it because I like it. I like the quality. I think that if you can't get a perfect lemon, why settle with a mediocre lemon? But then there's the other part of it, which is for me that having some limitations, even though they're self-imposed, it promotes creativity in a very good way. Because if you have everything all the time, which is the case in most great restaurants of the world, then I find it difficult to develop, you know, because there's just simply not enough incentive.
And it's not just about combining plants, fruit and vegetables, as Celia Chang discovered. You had mousse, I believe.
We did. That was the most spectacular gastronomic experience I've had because he and another chef brought in the femur of the mousse to the middle of the dining room, and they started sawing it open. And the dish was mousse heart served with fresh, extremely fresh mousse marrow that, you know, he scooped out from the femur that he had just sawed. So it doesn't get fresher than that. And it was amazing because, you know, it was still warm. So the marrow actually warmed up the entire dish.
And yet, despite providing this primal experience in his own restaurant, Magnus Nilsson thinks that all of us who eat meat should have to be licensed to do so.
It came from an experience I had when we first bought the farm that me and my family live on today. And I grew up hunting and I grew up fishing and we had the farm and all that stuff when I was a kid. But I never realized truly what it means to eat meat until later, until we did this. And it was the first year we had 6 ewes and their lambs over summer. And in Sweden, you're allowed to slaughter yourself at the farm for your family, for your own personal needs.
Right.
You can't sell it. So because of this, I just decided that, okay, the meat that we're going to eat, I'm going to slaughter this. I'm going to take care of it myself. And it was a very emotional thing. Like when I killed these two lambs that we kept for our own consumption and it took care of their bodies. And it made me think a lot about what it really means to consume meat. And I eat meat today and I'm intended on continuing doing so. But I really felt that if everyone had to do this in the whole world, raise an animal get to know it, get to know its personality, then kill it and eat it. If that was compulsory to do that once in your life, then I think we wouldn't have this problem with people over-consuming meat, wasting meat. I don't enjoy killing an animal.
But because you have done it...
I thought about it and
I... You've made peace with yourself over it.
Yes, I made a choice. It's an active choice. Logically, maybe I shouldn't eat meat. And this is a conflict that I have within, in a way. But still, I do it and I decided that I'm going to continue doing it. And I think, you know, it has to be an active choice. As long as you just don't do things without thinking. So I'm constantly confronted with this. And I'm okay with it. I feel all right.
Do you think you'd feel less all right about eating meat if you were more consistently buying that meat in a supermarket?
Probably not, because then I would probably be completely detached from it, like most people are today. And I think that's a problem. You know, you have to think about what that supermarket meat really is, you know, that some of it is good and other parts of it isn't. Look at foie gras, for example. A foie gras can have a great technical quality. It can be a super delicious thing. But it will never be produced in a way that feels okay to me. It's never going to be okay to stuff a bird full with corn until it basically dies from liver failure, which is what produces the foie gras. That will never be okay. That's never going to be produced in an ethical way.
If I come to your place, how much is a meal going to cost me?
If you buy everything that we think that you should buy, it's going to cost you about 320 euros. I don't know how much is that in Australian dollars, like 400 something. And then a hotel room is going to cost you 200 more. So it's an expensive restaurant, but you also get an amazing craftsmanship and very, very interesting stuff.
I don't doubt that. However, the clientele that appreciate what you do and the realm of the senses that you inhabit is something we'd all love to aspire to but rarely can afford.
No.
And I just wonder how it is that we can reconcile what are worthy philosophies from you with the fact that not all of us can afford to be like that.
To leave Australia and travel to Sweden just for dinner.
But no, you don't have to do that. Thing. I'm talking here about an outlook on life where we actually pay true value for the food we should be treasuring.
Yeah, and I don't have a good answer there, but only the thing I can see is if you look at my country in Sweden, in the mid-80s, the normal family used 30% of the net income every year to buy food. Today we use 10. So maybe it's a question about prioritizing what you think is important in life. If you think it's important to eat food that's produced by people you know in a community that you support, buy food from there of good quality, that's good for many more reasons than just being tasty, you might have to prioritize that before buying a new flat screen TV every 3 years or going on a vacation to another part of the world every year or whatever it might be that that money is used for today, you know. So it's a matter of prioritizing. I think much of this prioritizing is going to be done for us in the future because much of the consumption behavior we have today is going to be impossible to sustain. And the interesting thing is not if it's going to happen. It's going to happen. The interesting thing is if it's going to happen in an orderly and nice way that doesn't inflict too much problems on humanity.
Oh, I think we know the answer to that because human behavior never changes unless it has
to. It doesn't. We can hope.
So if you ever leave Favriken, do you think that would be the end of your cooking again?
I doubt that I will ever run a restaurant in Favriken. You know, to run a very ambitious restaurant, it takes a lot of your personal passion. And I really doubt that I will ever do that in another restaurant because I don't think I have that in me. You know, I think that I'm going to do Favriken until it's done, until I don't find it interesting anymore or until people stop coming there or whatever the reason might be that it's not going to be rewarding running the restaurant again anymore. And then I'm going to shut it and do something else.
Magnus Nilsson, it's been a pleasure. Thank you very much.
It's been very nice talking to you. Thank you.
And if you like, you can download longer interviews with both Magnus and New York food blogger Celia Cheng just by going to our webpage through abc.net.au/radionational. But right now...
Long stringy pasta, mum's homemade tomato sauce, none on my new shirt.
Angie Grant reading our youngest winning entry in our food and gardening haiku competition, where the prizes are two books, Flora, The Gardener's Bible, and Kitchen Table Memoirs, shared stories from Australian writers. And your response was incredible, almost 900 entries. And the 11 winners can be read through the Radio National front page, and we have links on the RN First Bite page as well. Here's two more of the winning food haikus.
You are what you eat. My children leave to me what's past its use-by date.
You don't write haiku like vegetation. Its sprouts kind of grow on you.
We made two wines. The first one is a GSM, which is actually a blend of three grape varieties, which traditionally you'd get in the Rhone Valley.
You're with RN First Bite, and last time, you may recall, I took you inside an Italian garage where olives were being preserved, passata is bottled, and salami is made. And now to another backyard producer, Nick Hakes, who, along with five friends, gather together every year to harvest, bottle, and then imbibe their own wine. I dropped in on the process as Nick prepares to strut this year's vintage at the local Darabin Homemade Food and Wine Festival.
So it's Grenache, Syrah, or Shiraz, and La Verdura, which in Italian called Mataro. So it's a blend of three great varieties. We get it trucked in from Riverland in South Australia. And the second wine we make is a Cabernet. There's a little bit of Shiraz in there. We actually pick our own grapes from the Yarra Valley.
Does picking and then making add to that sense of ownership of the wine compared to the one you get the grapes from the Riverland?
I think so. It's about understanding the process from start to finish. Ultimately, part of the journey is about spending time with people, your friends and family. And so if you can drive out in a bit of a convoy and spend time with the kids, you know, picking your own grapes, it just adds to it. I think when people say, oh, we make wine, they get a vision of, you know, this little cutesy winery out in the valley somewhere. But no, this is a vineyard in the middle of Thornbury.
A suburb that is very old, traditionally had a lot of Mediterranean population, mm-hmm. Greeks and Italians particularly.
Who we learnt from, Giovanni or John, was Ian's father-in-law. And, you know, he was Italian. We always knew he made wine. We sometimes tried his wine. And then one day we said, oh, can you actually show us how to make it? The first time we watched him make it, we said, oh, John, I'm pretty sure that you put it into a barrel at some part of the process. He said, don't worry about that part of it. You know, we're just making wine here. So the next year we went and bought our own little 50-litre barrel. He was shocked, and you know, we had changed his process, which he had refined over many, many years.
You young whippersnappers coming along.
It was terrible. It created tension for a little bit.
Did it? Really? Yeah.
But it was good. We watched him. We learnt from him. And then, yes, we've been making it for 7-8 years now.
In the backyard here?
In the backyard of Thornbury.
Can I go into your backyard with the wine we're drinking and see where you've made it?
Sure. We're going to have to take another bottle, though, because we have to try the second one.
Yeah, it's a long backyard.
Okay.
Yeah.
We're going to the shed.
You're going to the shed.
Yeah.
To the man shed.
We may be some time. And into a shed with a drop saw. We've got a couple of bikes hanging from the rafters, a nicely appointed tool bench. Everything in its place, and then I look around and there's part of my childhood sitting right there too, because my stepfather was a wine and spirit merchant, and in his retirement days Nick actually wanted to press his own wine, and you've got just what he had, a wine press.
This was Giovanni's wine press.
Oh, so he's given it to you?
Yeah, he probably bought it out from Italy with him. So this, I don't know how old it is, but this has had many vintages of wine go through it.
How many grapes go into this press to make the vintage every year for you in this backyard?
We buy a ton of grapes all up, so 80 cases.
80 cases, so roughly just under 1,000 bottles for your effort.
Yeah, depending on the amount of alcohol. We put it through the destemmer, start the fermentation. Fermentation can last anywhere between 5 and 7 days, depending on the temperature, and hand plunging every day. It goes into the mighty press.
Oh, okay, before we get to the mighty press, the hand plunging, you better describe this. What happens there?
We have big tanks. The grapes sit in the tanks. We start the fermentation process by killing the natural yeast, adding some new yeast to the grapes. That just starts to turn sugar into alcohol.
Yep.
And the process of fermentation can take between 5 and 7 days, depending on the temperature. And the hand plunging is somebody coming in here 3 to 4 times a day, rolling up their sleeves and just giving it a bit of a plunge.
So on a micro level, this is, you know, describing the process that all wineries go through, no matter how large they are.
It is. I don't think that the way of making alcohol has changed in maybe thousands of years.
Yeah.
And we learnt how to do it. It came from John. We drank lots of great wine without really appreciating how it was made. The very first time we made wine, we had read on the back of fancy labels that things were hand-picked. And so we bought in some bunches of grapes and we sat around a barrel hand-picking each individual grape. After about 4 hours, we had literally cases to go. And so what started off as this labour of love just turned into whole, you know, bunches of grapes being thrown in. So I'm sure John was sitting there laughing at us with a glass of wine in his hand.
How many people are involved in this whole process now?
There's 5 mates who have come together to make wine. We have a new addition to the family. It was called the Brotherhood because there were 5 mates just all making wine. And the new addition is Ian's daughter, Georgia. She's 10.
So you've got a 10-year-old girl now involved in making wine. Do you feel like that is abrogating your responsibilities as adults and older men?
She is definitely the most mature of the lot. She's probably the most knowledgeable of us all. She will definitely make better wine than we do because she's seen where we go wrong. She's the quality control person. She knows when someone's cutting corners and is quick to point it out. And she's the granddaughter of John, who we learned from. And what's really cool is that everybody has really young kids now and they watch us do it. And you know what? They're learning as well.
And when is the next vintage out?
Cup Day, 2013. We have them in the barrels. Did you want to try a little barrel sample straight out of the barrels of 2013?
Sure. Let's do that. Let's compare and contrast. Okay. How many barrels do you have here, Nick?
There's 6 barrels.
Okay.
6 barrels of GSM and Cabernet. We just got to take the heater out.
So you've got these barrels literally caught up in blankets just to keep the temperature up, have you?
Yeah, little sleeping bags. It gets a bit cold during the winter months. You know, the wine doesn't like to be left alone outside in the barrel room.
So who does?
Yeah. So we tuck him in and we give him a little heater just to stabilise the temperature.
And when did you get the barrels from?
We buy them from a cooper, another traditional occupation. We buy the French oak. Every year we add additional French oak to the wine just to impart the oak characteristics. And
when you say add French oak, just explain to people what you mean.
Well, the barrels are made out of oak.
Yeah.
And every year, you know, it imparts a little bit of oakiness to it.
Mm.
And so it diminishes. So we add just a little bit of oak staves or oak chips to the wine to help impart the oakiness.
Gotcha. So how long have you had these? You've had these barrels from the get-go?
Yes, they have been cleaned out a couple of times. So every couple of years, we take them to the cooper. They break them down, they clean them out, they shave them actually, and then they put them back together.
So that shaving just releases another new surface of oak into the wine for that next year.
That's right.
So this has been, just remind us, this has been in the barrel for how long?
This was put in the barrel in late February, early April. So couple of months, it hasn't gone through its first rack. So this essentially is wine which is 2 months old. We're extracting it straight out of the barrel just to see if it's bubbling away okay.
Okay.
And you're going to taste it first.
Oh, God. Here we go. And just reminding, this is the one from...
This is South Australia.
This is South Australia.
Yeah, right. GSM.
The GSM, right. Well, I mean, it's not hard to quaff. It's easy. It's very soft.
Still has some greenness to it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so what's interesting, still a little bit green, and still hasn't really captured that oak characteristic
to it.
Not
at all, no.
So I reckon that'll further develop. What I do taste is really grapefruit. It's got good acid, and I think time in the barrel will rack it off. I mean, the clarity's pretty good to start with, but 6 months more in the barrel, and I think it's looking good.
Well, let's try the Brotherhood's Spaz Block Cabernet Sauvignon. Here we go. This is 2012. Well, that's a quaffable wine, isn't it? That's going to do very nicely indeed. I could see us putting down some seats here and, you know, putting some music on and just settling down for the afternoon with that wine.
I thought that's what you're here to do.
I'm rapidly finding out that is actually the ulterior motive for doing the story. I wasn't even being truthful for myself. Nick, thank you very much indeed.
That's right. Well, thank you.
Cheers.
Cheers.
Deep purple beetroot, underground globe, perfect sphere, bomb of bright pigment.
That's another of your winning haikus read by Anita Barrow, who also happens to produce RN First Bite. The final haiku in just a moment. Melissa May is technical producer on this program. I'm Michael McKenzie, and please drop us a line in our comments section online or via Facebook and Twitter. We'd love to read what you have to say about us. Next time, we're off to Spain for the inaugural World Sherry Day, and why our relationship with this fortified wine is no longer confined to the surreptitious flagon in the back of the pantry. Or is that just me? Talk to you soon.
Your golden body dripping sweet, tempting nectar. I love you, honey.
If you're looking for the best live music, you're looking for the live set. But remember, the live set is also online. You can also download individual tracks and selected concerts, like Paul Kelly in concert and conversation with Lucky Oceans.
We have played it a lot over the years, Lucky and I, and it's just got two chords. We thought it could be a nice settler. This is a
rain. That's the live set. You can look for us on the RN homepage.